Hey everybody, welcome to the third episode of the Snapcast. I'm Bobby.
I'm Rob.
And I'm Chris.
So this week you may have noticed that we are missing Alex. He's currently down in Charlotte playing in the Modern Open, so hopefully he's doing well. I know he didn't day two the Modern Open, so he's playing standard today, so we wish him tons of luck.
We'll definitely
miss him this week. Also, before we get into this, I wanted to make a quick note that on MTGcast, we kind of got posted to the site a little bit after we started. So episode one just went up. Episode two will probably be up Monday. And then this new episode will be up today, Wednesday. And it will be just a weekly podcast. I didn't want anybody to see that and think that we're on some kind of crazy schedule. So, all right, with that, today we're going to be talking a little bit about mulligans first, and then we'll be coming back to talk about team building. So, first, guys, have you seen this new mulligan rule?
Yes. Very excited, and I was very happy to hear that it is finally coming to all competitive REL.
Yeah, so for anybody who isn't aware, at the last Pro Tour, Pro Tour Origins, they tried out a new mulligan rule where you still choose your mulligans like normal. You go down to six, down to five, whatever. But after you've resolved your mulligans, before you start the game, if you have mulliganed, you get to scry one before the game starts. So this is, it's an attempt to kind of, mulligans have always been a feel bad part of Magic. There's tons of games where you lose because you just had to mulligan to, you know, next to nothing. So this is kind of an attempt to ease that a little bit. So have you guys tried this at all? Any thoughts on it? How do you feel so far?
Me and Alex tried it on a side game in Modern. I like it because it gives you the chance for more interaction. I think that's what Wizards of the Coast is ultimately looking for, is how can I get more interaction throughout the game? Because, if you mulligan, heaven forbid, to like five, you're so far behind, especially if you're on the play, even on the play at that point. You know, it gives you that chance to come back, because, the last thing you want to do is mulligan to four or five and rip a land off the top most of the time.
Or not a land if you needed one. Yeah whatever right. You don't need is what you get, it seems like.
Another thing, too, is it's going to help you out if you keep your seven and then your opponent starts to go on the mulligan, because you can't tell if that matchup is good for you then. Yeah, you might have destroyed him, but how many cards did he start with in hand? Four? How can you really judge that match? So I think this is not only going to benefit the player who's mulliganing, but also benefit everybody else so they can really get a good judgment on how they are versus this deck.
Yeah, I think it's a tough sort of line to draw, because you can't make mulligans too easy or too cheap, because then combo decks, especially in Modern and Legacy, are going to run rampant. If they have too much opportunity to hand sculpt before the game even begins, they're just going to be way too powerful. So I'm impressed to see that Wizards is thinking about it. The mulligan rules haven't changed in a long time, so I'm glad that they're revisiting it. I think that pressure from Hearthstone is kind of what led to this, just because, obviously that's their competitor right now. Hearthstone's been picking up numbers like crazy. So the mulligan system, I'm not going to get into it, but it's way different in Hearthstone. The mana sort of system is way different, but it cleans the game up a lot. I think too much, because it makes it a little too simple, but it's definitely an answer to that. Long story short, I don't want to sidebar too much on that, but I'm glad to see that they're looking at it. This new mulligan rule will go into effect for the battle for Zendikar pre-release, and then it should be just all tournaments from that point on.
Yeah, I like how they did it, though, that you don't scry until your mulligans have resolved.
Right, yeah.
Which is, I think, the important thing. It's not, I'm going to look at six, scry, and then determine whether to keep. Because, you were talking about going to hand sculpting too much, that would just push it over the top. I'm glad it's, all right, I have this six or five or whatever the number may be. I'm happy with this. Now let me get some interaction before the game starts and see if I want to keep this or not.
It's going to be very interesting to see how this impacts Modern with the number of combo decks that have popped up, especially just this weekend. Also, down in Charlotte, with the new combo deck that came up, the mulligan system, is it going to greatly just give those combo decks the biggest advantage over your fair decks, if you will, your mid-range or your control decks in Modern? That's going to be very interesting to see, and I'm excited for it.
Yeah, I like it. It's not good enough to where you ever want a mulligan. You still don't want a mulligan because of it, so it's not like this incentive, but it just kind of cleans it up. Takes some of the feel bads away, that's for sure.
Yeah, I think Rob was saying, I think combo is going to have the biggest combo or control, one of the two, are going to have the biggest impacts on it. For Modern, it's just going to be huge, because whereas they may have had an okay five or six, now because of the scry. Now they could have a strong five or six on the draw, yeah. And it could really just put them back in the game where we're playing interactive magic now, not just, all right, yeah. Well, I'm getting more lands.
I'm just going to miss land drops or I'm going to flood out. And yeah, that's
well, either or, and neither one was really what I wanted.
Right, yeah. No, I think Delver was a big concern. A lot of people have been concerned about that, where you could set up, you know, a pretty good turn one flip on Delver. But I really think if you dig into the numbers, it's not going to be that big of an issue because there's so many variables that have to be in place. Like, you have to have turn one Delver. You have to have an untapped island that's not a fetch land. You know, there's all these things to where you can benefit from knowing what's on the top of your deck from the get-go. So I don't think it's going to really improve or hurt any specific deck. I think it's just going to be a nice kind of leveling out. So, but yeah, so let's get into some talks about mulligans. I definitely think mulligans are one of the things that newer players kind of struggle with, and even seasoned players. We've all been there at a tournament where you're looking at a five or a six and you just really are having a hard time whether or not you should go down to five or go down to four. How do you guys think about mulligans? Do you have a process? Do you,
The biggest thing is you need to look at the deck you're playing. You need to figure out what is your game plan. And it's also dependent on what game it is too in the round. Is it game two? Do you know what you're going against, or is it an unknown? Right. So you need to figure out, am I on my game plan? Or is this leading towards, I'm going to sit here and dirtle, do nothing, and hope to draw the two more cards that I need to make this work?
Right, yeah.
I really look at the tempo of the hand. We talk about tempo a lot. Do I have a turn two interaction? Do I have a turn three interaction that either swings it into my favor or their favor? And can I, the mulligan I take, is it going to get me towards the longer game? Not necessarily the long game, but do it with a simple.
Am I
going to
get out
draw,
of the gate? Basically,
yeah. Am I going to get to a turn three or a turn four play? And I think that's what you have to really look at it. Because I mean, obviously, if you're taking a five card mulligan, if you have four lands and you know a cantrip or a deal three damage, a lightning strike, whatever the case, obviously that's not a good hand. That's so much limited interaction. I think you have to really look at is, can I shift the tides of me having to mulligan off these cards in my hand? Or does it give me that window to draw into something to shift the tides? You know, if I need this card to really push it over, do I just need a land to get there? Because obviously in a couple turns, the odds are in my favor to rip a land.
Right.
So yeah. I think that's the biggest thing when I'm looking at. Do I have a quick interaction and something to move towards a couple turns down the road? That's really what I'm looking for.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I think a huge, huge portion of this is knowing the deck. That's definitely for sure. Because if you're running light on lands, you may be less inclined to keep like a one lander. If you're running like an aggro build, it's not as bad if it's one land. If you're running heavy in lands, you know, you have a higher chance of drawing them. So that's definitely a huge part of it. What has been, for each of you, the hardest deck that you've had to mulligan with?
To mulligan with?
Yeah, which choices were... You know what I mean? Like, some decks, it's pretty straightforward. Some decks, it's a little bit harder looking at opening sevens and knowing if it's good to go or not.
Mine would have to be Legacy, playing with Sneak and Show, because seeing a lot of cantrips in hand could be very enticing, but if you don't have at least one of the pieces for the show and tell or for the sneak attack, you're just going to sit there and cantrip. Yeah, you might be able to counter here and there. And Legacy is a format where it's built around countering and card draw. But if that's all you're doing, you're not going to be able to win.
What about you, Chris? Anyone stick out?
Mine would either be Boggles, because it's... You have the card draw to get out of it. But if you don't have that initial creature, I mean, you just got to keep mulliganing. And it doesn't get better.
Right,
I mean, it really doesn't. Not unless your mulligan takes you down to a creature, two lands, and a core spirit dancer to start getting cards back, you know. But it would either be Boggles or Legacy Elves. Legacy Elves, it's such a, to me, there's so many lines of play. It's so complicated that it's just hard, like, for me to want a mulligan.
Yeah, that's one where you're sitting there looking at, like, all right, I can, I think sort of five turns in advance, I can do this, I can do that, and kind of figure out if it's a keeper or not. And I mean, that's, for me, it was definitely the green-black constellation build I was playing in standard for a while. it got a lot easier, but it was a deck the first few times I sat down with it, I was mulliganing way too aggressively because most of the opening sevens just looked like a big pile of do nothing. Like, and I mean, it's a lot of setup involved in that deck. So I kind of, as you play the deck more, you get more and more used to it and you kind of learn these tall tale signs. But that's definitely like when you sleeve up a new 75, that's probably one of the first things you want to do is, you know, goldfish it, play it by yourself a little bit, force yourself to go to six or five and try to figure out like, all right, how does this deck mulligan? What are like sort of the key things I need in an opening hand that I'm just not going to be able to play Magic without? And I mean, some decks, it's a lot more simple, you know, burn. If you see four lands in an opening hand and burn, that's pretty much an auto mulligan. Like,
yeah, that's pretty much just you lose.
You're already at six effectively, like yeah. Even five, you could argue, because you really only need one or two lands. But then, you know, like a control deck, four lands, that's probably fine. If you have four lands and maybe a cantrip or a divination or something, like, yeah, you'll get out of it. But yeah, so knowing your deck is a huge part of it. And then Rob kind of touched on it earlier. We can come back to that now. Knowing like what your opponent's on. Have you guys ever, like, I know I'm guilty of this and I've fallen for it before where I'm playing against a player I know pretty well. I know what he's usually playing. I kind of mulligan with that in mind. And then, joke's on me. He's playing something else that day.
Yep. No, there's definitely that, especially game one. But then going into game two, that's really going to affect how you play. With Infect, if I'm going against Burn, generally with Infect, you'll keep a hand with one creature and a bunch of pump. But if you're going against Burn, you can't rely on that one creature. You have to count on it being bolted turn one. Yeah. So you need to be more thoughtful on what you're doing with your opening seven. And if there's only the one creature, you can't bank on that creature staying alive. You need to take that mulligan. And also you need to look at the speed of your hand too. If your opponent's on an aggro deck, again, going to Infect, that's the biggest thing I have experience with in Modern. You can't keep a hand where your creatures are your Ink Moth Nexuses because you're a turn behind and it's eventually, it's going to do you in the end.
Yeah. There's so many, when you're looking at what the opponent's playing, you've got to figure out, can I catch up, especially on a mulligan? And when I'm looking at a hand, that's what I'm looking at. Because, you know, like Rob was saying, if you go a turn or two behind on the wrong deck, there's just some decks they don't have enough card draw to put you back on
par.
That's
the game, man.
Yeah, so figuring out what they're on quickly is, I think it's more key on game one. And I'm not saying that you need to slow game one, but sometimes it's almost worth it to see what they're truly playing. Because you may think you're playing an aggro deck secretly because you ended game one so quickly. They have a sideboard combo or everyone, you know, they do the old bait and switches in the sideboard. Before you know it, you've brought all these cards in that are for the aggro, and it's really...
That's not what you're playing.
Yeah, it's really... And that's not what you're playing game two. So it's very important, especially on a mulligan, to figure out, to know exactly what they're on. It's a little harder on game one, but game two and three, you should have a good idea going in.
Yeah, game one, I've gotten to the point where I really try not to assume what my opponent's playing. And it's not something I did a lot, but I have caught myself doing it once or twice, and I feel like I've pretty much always paid for it in the end, so... You know, game one, you're looking for a much different thing in your opening seven. You're looking for sort of the epitome of your deck. You know what I mean?
You're looking for your game plan.
Yeah, you're focusing internal. Yeah. And then game two, yeah, you have to kind of reevaluate and go, okay, well, you know, these cards aren't good in this matchup, or these cards I don't need yet. I can, you know, like for control is a big one where card draw is usually great in the opening seven. But then if I'm playing against aggro, like I might not make it to a turn three divination, or I might be in a real bad position by then. So I really need to kind of forego, like if it's four lands, three card draw spells, like, ugh, that's not good at all against aggro and mulligan. But if I'm playing like a control mirror, that's a great hand, like keep all day. So, I mean, yeah, it's a lot of knowing your own deck and a lot of knowing what you're playing against. Yeah, game two and three definitely make for much more interesting mulligans because, yeah, like you said, game one, it's just kind of a, does this look like a good hand for my deck?
Yeah.
You only have internal information.
And I think, especially for game one, when it comes to the mulligan, just play your game and see if their deck can interact with it. Because your opponent's going to play their game, and you're going to see if you can interact with it.
Yeah.
You know, that's the biggest thing.
And I think with game one, too, you can keep hands that almost look like trap hands, if you will. And those are hands where it looks good at first, but then you start thinking about it. Turn two, turn three, you're like, oh, wait, this actually isn't working out well. Whereas game one, you can do it. You can keep hands with, say, two scry lands. Because yeah. your opponent's, he's doing the same thing. He doesn't know what you're playing. So you can be a little bit more conservative on your mulligan there and hopefully be able to execute your game plan to the best of its ability.
Yeah, mentioning the trap hands, these are the hands that...
Almost there.
Yeah, there it's, I need this.
If and there I'm was there. This one other card, this would be perfect.
But it's usually not something as simple as just like a land or... It's I need two lands, not yeah. one land.
You or know? A certain color.
Yeah.
Or,
yeah, I need this one piece. And they're, I think they're some of the more dangerous
yes.
hands. I've kept them. Alex isn't here to attest to it, but I will keep some, especially yeah, like...
No, I've heard.
Sometimes you just got to trust the cards. And I mean...
Well, I've seen you play before, and there was one hand that you kept. It was a standard IQ at one of our local game stores. Alex and I, we were already done with ours. I believe you were in game three, and we looked, and we saw, and we're like, oh, man, he needs to mulligan this, and you kept it. And we're just like, what is he doing? Now, you pulled it out. Great. Good for you. Maybe the hand wasn't as much as a trap to you because you knew the deck, but wow.
That was the... You needed green, right?
Yes.
You
had no green sources. Double white playing like we make rocks in my hand, and I had
early drops were green.
Yeah, all my early drops were green, and I pulled two forests off the top. I mean, they couldn't even believe that, and it was against Abzan of all decks.
Yep. Yeah. No, we walked away. We really thought here it's like, ah, oh, well, here goes Chris's other loss. This isn't good.
He comes up later. I got it. What? How?
Yeah. Pretty much.
I can't give a thumbs up to that. I gotta say that was a mulligan hand all day, but hey, man, it worked out.
Yeah, I mean,
more power to you.
I mean, it is the trap hands that was the interaction you need. I mean, obviously, you got to know what are your chances on ripping the lands you need off the top, but sometimes it's not always the best plan. Sometimes yeah. I'll trust the deck. You know, yeah. Hey, I'm gonna give this a shot. This deck's been performing real well. And I think I'm not telling people to do it. I think sometimes, because I play the game for fun, so sometimes you just need to do that and see. And that's, to me, that's a true test of the deck. So the trap hands, you got to really watch. And when you're evaluating, is this a setup? Is this hand going to lose me the game? You got to start running probabilities, because Magic's just solely, it's a game of math.
It's numbers. Yeah, that's all it is.
It's nothing but ratios, and I have a 1 in 7 chance of drawing this or whatever the case. And you have got to know from the beginning, because your best chances are off the opener because you're ripping 7 off the top, you know.
Yeah.
What are the chances of me getting to this? And I mean, if you've got a decent probability, I mean, why not play it every now and
then? There's also then the angle of the payoff, too. I mean, if it's a hand where, like, if I draw a land in the next 2 or 3 turns, I just win this game, then, hey, go for it, you know? There are some trap hands where you kind of fall for this, and it's like, it's not even, the payout's not even that great.
If
you
yeah.
It's not bad. It's a great hand, but in this matchup, it's not as backbreaking as you may have thought.
Yeah, it's all risk versus reward. I mean, if it's high risk but high reward, and you think the probability, the ratio is there, sometimes it's okay to do it. If you have a high probability of getting it, why not?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this is more prevalent in Modern, but in Modern, there's a lot of cards that people will refer to as silver bullets. Spellskite comes up a lot in a bunch of different matchups, things like that, where if you're looking at opening 7 and it's a pretty bad hand, but it has that card in it and enough mana to at least cast it, maybe go for it. I saw a game on camera yesterday. I can't remember the specifics of it, but that was the case. The guy got stuck as Grixis Control on 2 lands for like 5 or 6 turns, but he had a card out that just kind of shut the match down, and he had plenty of time to get those other lands, and he knew it. He won that game.
Like,
so,
like Leyline of Sanctity for me. If I'm playing Boggles in a burn matchup,
I
almost don't even care what's in my hand. If I have a Leyline of Sanctity in the opener, I'm playing it. And I've got people, they won't even play the game. I've had burn players just scoop. And they're like, hey, I only have, 12 creatures, so I lose.
Whenever I was playing Amulet Bloom, I would have 4 Leyline of Sanctities in my sideboard, and I would almost mulligan until I got one.
Yep.
Unless it was,
it's just that good.
Yeah. Unless it was close, me going to 4 cards, at which point it would be almost pointless, because, great, I got the Leyline, now I'm only starting with 3. But even still, at that point, it's good, because I'm able to do the combo for Amulet, as well as completely shut down my opponent.
Yeah. Yeah, you're going down in cards, but if it shuts down the game to that extent, like...
Right.
I mean, you
at some point, it becomes worth it. Yeah,
you've got it. And it may not be the best hand, so, like, you have trap hands, but if you get a trap hand with a silver bullet, I mean, I almost say you got to pull the trigger and...
Yeah.
And let's go with it, because it's gonna balance out the scales so much that it's worth it.
You'll have time to recover.
Yeah, I'm going to get turns because, oh, well, I can't be targeted. So
yeah,
let's play.
Now we do have to make a side note there that Burn does usually side an enchantment hate, so be careful. It's not shutting down the game permanently, but what is it, a 2-drop or 3-drop that they usually bring in?
I run Destructive Revelry. It's a 2-drop.
So, you know, but it puts them on having to have it. And that's also where you have to get to the side where you're like, all right, how much did they mulligan? Yeah. Are they down some cards? Can I afford to be okay with this? And yeah, but I mean, so at the end of the day, like, you'll see that all of these always come back to the same theme of knowing your own deck, knowing your opponent's deck, and knowing the matchup. I mean, that's really what it comes down to. I think that new players and even some pretty good players kind of get in this mindset where they go, they look for, I need like 3 spells, 4 lands, snap keep. That's so good. They don't read the spell. They don't really think about, you know, what they're going to be doing. They just look for that like sort of displacement like that. That's not a bad way to start, but you really have to look at each hand and think, what is this matchup going to look like? Yeah. What am I facing against? Like, what do I know? Like burn, like Rob was saying earlier, they're probably going to burn your first infect creature. Like if they don't, they've kept a horrible hand. So yeah. You could pretty much bank on that. So you either need to slow roll with some protection or you need multiple creatures. You need some way to deal with that. And you can't keep a hand that can't deal with that. But I mean, it really, like, I know me, as far as physically mulliganing, I've gotten in the habit of laying out 7 cards and looking at one at a time just to kind of force myself to slow down, make sure. Because I know when we first started playing much more seriously, there were times where I would keep a 7 and then quickly, like turn 2 or turn 3, go, why did I keep this? It looked good at first, but I didn't really think about like the longevity of this hand.
Yeah.
That's another key thing too, is read every card that, you know, you do have in your hand. Sure, you know your deck and you know the cards. But
take 2 seconds. Yeah, don't just glance at it. I know I've misidentified a card many times. So be sure you know what you're really starting with.
Yeah, you got to make sure they interact with each other well. Not just, you know, if you're keeping just 4 spells, is it essentially 4 singletons that don't complement each other, or is it 4 cards that they kind of feed each other, or they work well with each other?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's a huge
key. 4-card game plan is better than a 7-card do nothing hand any day of the week.
Yeah.
I mean, so it's definitely, you know, you've got to look at it from all angles. You've got to count for all variables. And it's something that, you know, it sounds like a lot at first, but as you do it more and more, it just becomes sort of clockwork. And that's where you get to the point where you have to make sure you're forcing yourself to take a second to actually do it and not just glancing at stuff and like taking that for granted. But yeah, I mean, before we get out of this segment, what is the lowest you've ever mulliganed to in a game?
3.
Yes. How'd that game go?
Surprisingly, it went well, but it was infect, and I knew I was playing a deck that didn't have a lot of creature hate, and I ended up having a Blighted Agent with the 2 lands, and that was it. Oof. It was 2 lands and Blighted Agent, and it's like, I'll keep it. I'm unblockable. The guy's going against, I knew the deck decently well. I knew it didn't have too much creature hate.
Yeah.
I think maybe 8 cards total throughout the deck, so decent probability, but I had to go for it, and I ended up ripping just a whole bunch of pump, and it was great.
Well, plus, I mean, at 3, like, do you ever mulligan to 2? I don't think I've ever hit 2.
No.
3 is pretty much like, is there a land? Yeah, all right, let's try it.
Or if not, good game.
Yeah. Mine's been 4.
4.
And it was the, what is it, the 8-rack or hate rack?
That's what you were playing against?
Yeah.
Oh, man.
And I was on Boggles at the time. And I really wish I would have kept the 7. Because the 7 was good, but it didn't have the ley lines to shut what he was doing.
Ah, you got greedy.
And that's, I was like, the worst. And so if I would have kept the 7, like, because it went, Boggles versus it went the long game.
Yeah.
Whereas if I'd have just kept my 7, it would have been over turn 3. But I was like, you know, oh, he's going to
lily you and
rip and your hand none of it hit the field until like turn 8 or 9. And I was like, man, if I'd have just kept my 7, this game would have been over a long time ago.
Yeah, I think the lowest that I've ever mulliganed to is also 3. I don't even know if I played a land that game. It was kind of the same idea what Chris mentioned earlier. We're like, you know, just play it out. Just draw a turn and discard to hand size. Let your opponent show you what he's doing. You know, at least pick up some free information. Keep them in the dark. They won't be able to sideboard. I mean, it's something. So it's worth, you know, it's worth something if that's all you got at that point. But all right, cool. Well, we're going to take a quick break and we'll be back in just a minute to talk about team building. All right, welcome back, everybody. So for this segment, we want to talk about team building. I think this is the single most thing that's helped me in my Magic sort of career so far. It's just opened a lot of doors. It's made a lot of things easier. So I really, this is something we thought was important to share with listeners because I think it's something that everyone can harness pretty well. We kind of, just to give you some quick background here, Rob and I knew each other growing up. Spent quite a few years apart. He moved away. He came back, and that's kind of when we got serious about this again. We met Alex at a tournament and just kind of hung out and chit-chatted with him for a while. Ended up running into him at more events, and eventually we just all kind of got together more often on our own, and we would plan to meet up, and we would share rides and stuff. And then a few months later, you know, we met Chris, and that's sort of when, at this point, we were looking at, we started calling ourselves a team more. We were focusing more on that. And we were really looking for more people to kind of round that off. So it's something that kind of happened naturally for us, but it's also something that as we've gotten more and more serious about, we've just been seeing more and more benefits. Guys, what's your favorite part about this so far?
The main thing I like about having a player group, and you don't even have to be as out there as to call yourself a team, but it's, I like saying it's a team because it's more than just, hey, I did well at a tournament. No, it's we did well at a tournament.
Right.
Because yeah. It's not just my playing that helped me do well, or it's not your playing that helped you top 8. No, it's the ability to get the feedback from everybody on your team. And one of the best things I like is our team is very diverse. We have control players, mid-range players, combo players, aggro. It's just, we hit all facets of it. We're all experienced in what we know. And we're able to pick up on other things and then get the feedback. And it helped create, it helped make us into the better players that we are today and gives us a lot more insight on other decks.
Yeah, it's definitely been, I mean, it's like you kind of touched on a little bit, and that's an important part. Like, I think some people kind of hear people call themselves a team and kind of roll their eyes. Like, oh, these guys, they're so serious. These tryhards calling themselves a team. And that's the point. It's like, it's not calling yourself a team for the benefit of like, giving yourself credibility. Oh, we're so good. We need to be a team. It's more so just, yeah, that idea of, you know, we all better each other. And everyone knows, like, you can take great Magic players and drop them off at events, and you just don't have it some days. So it's really good to be able to go, like, all four of us to an event. One person does well, and it feels like a win for the whole group. It's one of those things where we can appreciate who's doing well, and it kind of keeps you away from that feel bad of like, oh, well, I had to mulligan. I had bad games, bad matchups, whatever. It was a, you know, crap day for me. So it kind of turns into this sort of group experience. And I mean, I think that really it's nice. Magic's an intricate enough game that you benefit greatly from having people around you that have watched you grow as a player. They know what your bad tendencies are. They know what your good tendencies are. I mean, no one's going to break down your game and analyze it as well as people that know you like that. Chris, what's been your favorite part?
I kind of like the consistency about it. We know before a tournament, we all try. Usually we meet up at Bobby's house, you know. We plan some sort of food or whatever, and we run what we call the gauntlet, you know. And so we get to test each other. So, you know, Rob likes combo and aggro. So he's going to sleeve up a combo or an aggro deck, and I'm going to get to try it. And we're just going to go around and... So you get to see what to expect. You get consistency with the players. You get a little bit of, and I think this is an important side of Magic. You get a little financial reprieve, you know, because people, you can borrow cards. Hey, I'm not playing this. Yeah, go ahead and use this. Now you only need to buy this. You get reduced costs in traveling. It's the stability of the team that I truly enjoy of, hey, we're going to go do this. We make plans several out of times. We know how to prepare. We pick days, you know. And then you get those outside eyes. All right, this is what I'm going to play. And I like like specifically how we do it, we don't correct right at the play. We go back and it's like rewind the tape. All right, you did this. You should have done this.
Right.
It's just all that experience, you know, coming, getting fed back to you for that lack of playing that, or the lack of experience prior to playing the deck, that you can just get soaked up all at once, or soak up as much as you can. And then just the fun. I think that's the other huge thing. I mean, I play this game for fun. I'm the youngest in Magic playing. I'm the youngest player. You know, I just come back here recently, started playing again, and said, hey, I don't want to do this just for fun. I want to play competitively for fun.
Yeah.
So it's like I get to draw on all your experiences on how to play better. So whereas time is something that I can't just make up, I can reduce the amount required to get at that same next level, you know. And then we're over here, we're having fun, we're doing whatever. It's just I think a team makes it more enjoyable. So if you're having that bad day, at the end of that round, you go and you talk to your guys and they're like, man, I mean, you know, you're beating up on yourself because you lost, but it's your teammates who are like, well, if he has the answers and he has the cards, you just can't.
It is
you
what it win is. That. Yeah.
Yep.
You got to take it off. And they help put that in front of you. Like, it can't always be you. If they have the answers, they have the answers, you know?
Yeah, and it's a good point where, like, it's one of the hardest things in Magic is being able to self-reflect and see, like, okay, was it really my playing, or was it the deck that I was playing, or my opponent? And sometimes it's easy to kind of subconsciously tell yourself, like, ah, no, I just didn't have it. So it's nice to have people around you that you respect that can step in and say, like, nah, you messed up. Like, it is what it is. You messed up. This was a misplay. You shouldn't have done that. And you need to hear that at times. And that could be a hard thing to hear, like, both in Magic and in life. So if it's people that you've formed these deep bonds with, it's so much easier to hear that. Like, I'm never going to tell any of you guys to go F off if you say something was bad. I'm like, yeah, they're probably right. Like, I'll have to deal with that later. And then also just knowing, like Alex and I are both the type where we don't want feedback immediately. We kind of get high in salt there right when it happens. So it's nice to have people around that know, like, all right, I'm going to let him complain and whine about this for a minute, and then I'll step in and tell him what it really is. And so that's, you know, there's a lot of things I would have missed out on if I didn't have people kind of watching closely who really wanted me to improve also.
I think one thing, too, that's beneficial with having your team or your group is just you have other eyes out there looking for new ideas, not just for themselves, but for you as well. There might be a really nice mid-range deck that did really well at a couple IQs or did well at a couple PPTQs. And they're like, hey, take a look at this list. And you're looking at it and you're, this is awesome.
Yeah, I would have missed this otherwise. Yeah.
And that's really good. And also they kind of steer you away from the decks that you should not be playing. They're like, right. Hey, man, you're an aggro player. Yeah, you might like this control build, but don't do it.
Try it out. Borrow mine. Give it a whirl. Don't go all in.
I think one of the best examples of that was when we went to Richmond. I mean, what, almost a year ago? We came over to Bobby's. We were running the gauntlet. You had seen green black constellation.
Yep.
We sleeved it up. Bobby said he'd play it. He ended up liking it. I mean, goes on to top 8 up at Richmond with the deck. And I mean, he got to make up for, because we were already, what, 3 or 4 hours into play testing the different decks.
Yep.
But he got to make up that difference because you had a deck, I had a deck. You know, we had all these decks proxied up. And then, especially when it came time to the top 8, we let Bobby go to sleep and we proxied his matches.
That's a huge
and
help.
We took notes, and so when he woke up, we were there like, hey, we missed out on sleep. Well, you went to sleep shortly after, so you could be as you could drive him there.
Yep.
Me, Ryan, and Alex stayed up. We wrote the notes, so all Bobby had to do was get up, eat, and just focus on his game, you know, for going in there. And then we caught up on a little bit of sleep and then met him there.
Yeah, I want to back up on this just real quick to kind of make sure it's clear for everybody. So the way the old open format worked was if you made top 8, you would come back the next morning to play your top 8 matches, and you got access to all the deck lists that night. So what they're talking about is like literally, I mean, I was able to go back to the hotel. I was exhausted. I crashed, you know, we ate, went to bed, and the other guys sat up. We had a nice like two room setup in the hotel, and they sat up for hours and just play tested against my first matchup for me. So when I woke up the next day, you know, I had my deck box sitting on the table with a nice little note sheet of how to sideboard, how to play the match, what to worry about, what to not. And it was a huge help because it was a pretty new build at that time. It was kind of that Jeskai aggro combo build. And I honestly didn't know how to play that matchup at all. We hadn't tested it at all. So, I mean, that was just huge. That's probably definitely my favorite moment of just like feeling the benefit of a team. I mean, holy cow, that was great. But yeah, so, I mean, it's there's so many benefits and stuff like that. Just it helps so much. Long days, long tournaments, like it's easy to get burned out. And it usually works out where with us, a group of four, we usually have two doing pretty well and two that are kind of on the line, you know, waiting to get that third loss to be knocked out. So we make a big point to where the people who aren't doing as well, you know, they'll go grab food, they'll bring stuff, they'll make sure the other people are doing well so they can focus on their game. And I mean, we've all done it for each other, and like it just, man, just makes the day so much easier.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with that. And that team support too, as you're going through the mental grind. I mean, because you've been there, Bobby, with 9 rounds. I've been there with 7 rounds. Chris, you've been there with 7+ rounds also. It gets very stressful.
Oh, yeah.
But whenever you're able to have that group that you can go up to and just unwind, it's great. It's so much better than being by yourself. I've been to IQs by myself a couple hours away, and it's not as great, I saw, yeah, without having that small group or that team there to help you out, because you're trying to think through everything, or you're trying to text them and you don't get the response in time. So now you're like, oh no, I don't know what I did wrong. And it could bug you for the rest of the day.
Yeah. I like just being able to come out and with the team there. Yeah. You may want to hit some of the technical side. Hey, I saw this, you know, how's this matchup? But the other thing is just being able to talk to them and be like, man, where are we going to eat after this? And like not, and it gives you that vent to not focus on Magic.
Yeah.
And let your brain almost just like relax for a second.
That's a big one for me. I like to come out, we'll make some jokes, crack up a little bit, goof off, and then all right, it's game time again.
Yep.
So we've kind of talked about the benefits, which I mean, we could go on for 20, 30, 40 more minutes, if not a whole nother cast on the benefits. But do you guys have any specific tips on how to build a team?
Don't just slap any group of people together for a team. Yeah. Make sure you know each other. You know your tendencies. Make sure you all have the same goals in mind, too. You might have your casual FNM player or your serious FNM player, but yet there's somebody who wants to grind IQs and PPTQs. And the other people, they might not just want any bit of it. And if so, I mean, that's fine. If you want to keep playing with them, by all means, keep playing with them to help out your game. But that might not be a good fit for your team.
Yeah, especially if you know that they never want to move on. If they have aspirations of playing IQs, then yeah, sure, you can probably make that work. But if they're strictly, I want to play rogue decks and budget builds at FNM, there's nothing wrong with that. But you can't pair that with, you know, like you said, a PPTQ grinder where they're just on completely different pages. Also, yeah, I mean, find, like, be patient. Don't push it. Don't rush it. Like, just find people you click with well. That goes a long way in the long run. Also, as far as just kind of logistics, I mean, it's kind of goofy, but we've been using Facebook Messenger where we have all four of us kind of in this ongoing chat that's always up and running. And like, that's been awesome. Like, it's great when I have a random Magic thought at work, I can just throw it in the chat and then I look back later and I've got feedback on it. Like, that's awesome. I would definitely suggest that for anybody considering it. Like, that's a great way to stay in touch. And then, like Chris said, you know, we all kind of know each other's schedules. So you want to try to find people who are on similar schedules. I mean, if you're never going to be free on the same days, then that's not going to work, obviously. If you're only going to be free on the same days once every month or so, that's probably not going to work either. Like, you need a group that's going to be able to go to the same tournaments, do the same things. Anything else? You guys got any other suggestions?
No.
I think the other one to look at is play styles.
Oh yeah, no, that's a great point.
You know, we use the term that if we all play aggro or we all play control, yeah, we're gonna be great in the mirrors all day long.
Yeah.
But if we're not trying anything else, it doesn't give us the ability to grow.
That's key.
So look at all right, so we Bobby and Alex both like control, but Bobby and Alex, they'll also sleeve up. Alex is really, Bobby really loves his control.
Yeah, yeah,
but no, Alex, I'm a hard Alex stone has to push. No problem sleeving up a mono red aggro build if it's powerful. You know, I prefer, you know, some sort of aggro or combo, but I'll look at mid range. If I think mid range is where it's at, that's where I'll go. I mean, and I've even, I borrowed blue black dragons from Bobby for a tournament one time. And, you know, you want to make sure that maybe even if it's not your play style, you have other people that is their play style. So not only you can get that experience from them, you can grow for when you're playing what you want to play.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know how to go into that match against them. Because, hey, I know if I expect to see a lot of control because it just won an open and I'm going to go to a PPTQ or an IQ, I'm going to have Alex or Bobby sit down across the table and play control nonstop so I can see, all right, these are my venues, these are my ways to go. You know, and it allows that. If I'm going to play mid-range and Rob's playing aggro, I'm going to play him, so I'm going to see which way the aggro is going to try and slip through. It allows you to grow. So don't get stuck, because you'll see it in, I think it's most prevalent in FNM. You'll find the two or three guys that stick together, but they all play aggro. They all play aggro, or they all play control, and they're like, I just can't figure this aggro out. Well, you got to sleeve up some aggro, or someone has to figure out when your times of opportunity are. You know, so you got to diversify a little bit, or at least have the ability to play those decks proficiently.
Right, yeah.
And have players also in your group that are open to that criticism. There are going to be some times when you go to make a play and you just need to hear that was wrong. And you need to accept that. You need to realize that these people you're calling your team, you're trusting them with everything pretty much when it comes to the world of Magic. And if they tell you did something wrong, in your mind, you might think, no, that was 100% the right move. It might not have been. And you really need to be open to that. And you need to be open to trying new things also to help out your teammates, because it's not just about you at that point. Once you get the other people in, you need to help them out, because that's how you're going to grow as a team and as a player.
Yeah, I mean, there was the Legacy PTQ. We went, I was watching you because I had the bye because I was busy losing. at a professional rate, and you know, and I was watching you, and when you came out, you know, I gave you the chance to vent or whatever, and then I was like, Rob, why did you do this? And you tried to explain the lines, and I'm like, no, that's not how that card works. And you're like, well, yeah, I messed it up then. And it's like, all right, now did we learn? If I mean, elves was there, it was pretty prevalent, and I'm like, all right, so now we know what this card does. It doesn't work like that, and you didn't make that mistake anymore. You were able to take that criticism and learn from it, I think, is the biggest thing.
Right.
And part of that, you know, is how people approach. I mean, if you just come up and you're as... even among friends, you got to find that the proper way to approach someone and say, hey, you messed this up. You can't just be rude about it even to them.
Why are you so dumb?
Well, there's that, oh man, there's always that guy in almost every tournament that just wants to blatantly call out people's misplays, and he's like wrong half the time. And it's just like, I mean, I feel for people, but like the social skills are just super low, and they blurt, well, that was wrong. That was no one's going to learn that way. Like there's a lot of players who are going to want to point out what you're doing wrong out of spite. They kind of want to say like, I'm showing how good I am by putting this person down. And that's where a team works out, because it's a totally different level. It's not out of spite. It's not to show how better I am. It's because we all want each other to get better. And I mean, it's the outlook of, as the people around you get better, you get better. Your playtest opponents are better. Like it expands on everything tenfold.
Yeah. And the other part of that coin is where they want to show you where the play was wrong was the good side of the coin, because I mean, you know, where there's heads, there's a tails too. Of that was the best play you could have made right there.
Yeah.
You know?
Yep.
And they show you where you played right, like, because I mean, there's been times that I mean, people sit back and does he see this line of play? Does he see that this is a complete tempo swing or a blah? And when they hit it, for you to come outside and they're like, the fact that you nailed saw it. That, you yeah. nailed it.
Good
like,
catch.
You could not have played that any better. And that's what kind of pumps you up. And, you know, it can't just be the bring you down or this is how you misplay. There's got to be the ups too, you know, because I call it like the corporate sandwich. The good, the bad, the good.
Nice.
You want to keep them, You want to keep them entertained and trapped, but you want them to still take that bad,
yeah.
extract what they need from it, but still end on a good note. Because if you leave me, you know,
if this it's just is all down all the time,
I'm going to go into game one of the next match of I did this bad. And now maybe I'm focusing on what I did wrong instead of just playing my game. So the total package that a team can bring of keeping you up when you need to stay up, making you see your mistakes, you know.
Yeah.
Making it easily affordable to go and travel, because I mean that's a huge thing too. I mean we travel.
Yeah.
I mean we go to North Carolina. You've been to New Jersey.
We've gone to Baltimore. Yeah, New Jersey, a bunch of Maryland. Times.
Yeah, Baltimore a lot. Even Ohio, which was about a 9.5 hour drive. Yeah. But having that team though to be able to go is for the Columbus Invitational.
Where did Alex go? Alex went to one real far away.
Yeah, too. Well, that was on his way home. He's hit Memphis, was kind of an Indianapolis.
Yeah, like,
but still having that player though, the invite was there for the rest of our group. Hey, I'm heading out this way. You want to tag along? None of us could, sadly, but.
Plus, I mean, like, man, like, some of the 4-hour trips in cars I've had with you guys have been some of the best, like, times of my life. I mean, we have a blast joking around and goofing off. And, I mean, it just, like, that turns something that would be so tedious and boring into a good time. And, I mean, I also, like, we've kind of branched out a lot more recently where we'll even travel a little bit for, like, PPTQs and IQs. And, like, it can be intimidating going to a new shop for the first time. I mean, especially if you find yourself in one of those shops where they have the same 12 players at every single event. They all recognize you immediately as a new face. You're this guy kind of standing by himself. And like, it's nice to have that group to walk in with and be comfortable. I mean, I'm comfortable enough around you guys that I can pretty much walk into any store and not really care what's going on around me. Like I'm comfortable.
Yeah.
And that can put you on tilt so bad if you have that like, oh man, like what's going on in this place? They're all kind of talking to each other. Everyone's like, and it's a goofy thing to point out, but I mean, it does. It affects you at least on some level. So it's nice that we can kind of walk in anywhere and just be comfortable and casual and not have that affect our game at all.
Yeah. Plus that when you go into the new store, I mean, we've all talked about it. There's that one guy who just makes the comments that irks you.
Yeah.
And like, you guys are my woosaw. You know, because that guy makes the comment and then like the eye starts to twitch a little bit.
Starts popping out.
Like, oh, hey, let's come over here and smoke a cigarette or something, you know, and it's like, all right, yeah, it's not that big of a deal. You know, let's just go over here and let's do what we do.
Because that's not stuff you need to be thinking about during tournaments. And I mean, it I'm sure it affects everyone on some level, some more than others. But yeah, I'm kind of the same way. We're like, a lot of these stores have this, like, you know, the old boys club kind of feel where, like, we recognize outsiders and we don't take kindly to strangers and that kind of vibe to them. So, like, yeah, it's kind of awesome to be like, man, whatever. You know, if you guys want to be like that, that's fine. But we got a fun, we're laughing a lot out here. We're having a good time. We don't care.
Yeah.
I think what's surprising, too, is sometimes you'll go to these local stores and because you're with your team and you are comfortable, you're relaxed, you're actually more relaxed than the regulars that are there.
Yeah, because they're all uncomfortable. Who are these guys here? We've never seen them before. They seem so comfortable. Like, what's going on here?
Well, in the trip, the experience of it's the other half. I mean, you're going to play Magic regardless, but
yeah.
I mean, it's the trip where I think we have the most fun. I mean, yeah, we go there, we play Magic, but it's the conversations and going to get the dinner.
Goofing off. I mean, it adds this level to where, like, the trip doesn't feel like a bust if you O2 drop.
Yeah.
You're still having a blast. Like, I still come back refreshed, relaxed, which is nice because otherwise you come home stressed out. You got to go to work on Monday and you're like, man, like, why did I even do that this weekend?
Or you're dreading the drive home.
Yeah, that's another one, yeah. And then, I mean, we've even had times where, like, Rob has kind of tagged along on something where he got off of work and left for the tournament immediately. Guy hasn't slept for, you know, 12 to 24 hours. He's exhausted. And we'll drive home and he'll sleep in the back seat. Like, it's nice to be able to, like, make up for other people's schedules like that.
Or you guys will be the cops watch for me while I'm speeding down the interstate.
Yeah, that was an interesting day for sure.
Mile marker, 287.
Ding! On your left, bogey on the left.
Got within 3 miles of you guys leaving half an hour later.
Yeah, that was a crazy day. But so one of the other things, too, that we've done sort of recently is we had team shirts made. And I know you guys have noticed that when we go to some shops, people will kind of like not openly poke fun, but you can tell they're like, these guys, like, what's going on? These guys in their team shirts, what a bunch of dorks. But like, I love it. Like, I want to know that if I'm sitting at a top table and you guys are standing near me, I want everyone there to know, like, this is why I'm beating you right now. Like, I've had all this help from these guys. Like, this is a group effort. This is not just me at this point. And I mean, that's the biggest thing about it is, like, you just want to represent that group. It's not like this weird intimidation tactic where we want to look like all super pro in our little shirts, but no, it's just like, it's solidarity. Like, we enjoy each other's company and we're all a big part of why we're doing well at this game. So we want everybody to know that.
I personally like when they make the little comments about the shirts, like, oh, you know, team such and such, what's that about? Like, all right, well, you know, this is what it's about or whatever.
Yeah.
And they're like, they like you can tell they just want to say, like, you're a dork or whatever.
Yeah, they want to say something, but they just can't.
And I want to be that guy at the end and be like, yep, and at the end of this match, I will be the king of the nerds. So yeah. It is completely worth it, you know?
Well, it's also that, like, it always feels like it kind of comes from a place of envy. Because usually it's the guy that there by himself, like, you know, he drove himself there. He maybe has one buddy there. And, like, it's like, look, these are my buddies. Like, we're having a blast. We're not here to, like, impress anybody else. We're here to have a good time together. And yeah, that's, like, what that sort of represents.
Well, the last time we went to Richmond, we had the team shirts for the small modern tournament. And at the end, well, we went to your uncle's bar. So, like, you know, it was cool at the end.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
No matter what you say at the end, I mean, we're going to take a little stroll. We're going to go to the bar, get something to eat, have a
blast.
And regardless of what you think, you know, we're still going to have a good time, you know, and that's why I like it. Even on the worst day, you know, we always find a way to go and make something good about it, which makes you want to go and play again. I mean, it really does.
Plus, we constantly get to hear about how people played against other team members. I don't know if you guys I get this a lot. Almost every single tournament, like, oh, I played one of your buddies earlier.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, and cool. like, how do you know? Then you look down, and you're like,
oh, yeah, right. That's right. We're all matching. Yeah, yep. Got it.
Or they recognize you before. They're like, oh, hey, I remember playing you in Baltimore, and now you're in Richmond playing this guy.
Well, that and, like, Alex and I, all right, Alex and I do not look that similar, but somehow there is this running, like, we get identified as each other constantly. So I'll constantly hear, like, oh, yeah, you know, yeah, you beat me last week playing so-and-so. Like, that was not me at all. Like, so it's, oh, man, do we want to blow the joke? We'll let you in on a secret here. We started this running joke a while ago that Alex and I are brothers. We're not related at all.
No.
We don't even look that much alike. I don't know where people get this, but...
We have a couple stores convinced that they are, and it's hilarious.
There's probably people that are listening to this right now that thought we were brothers. Like, this has been going on for over a year now. Like, there's people in Baltimore that think we're brothers. Like, up and down the East Coast, people think we're brothers. Despite having different last names and not really looking alike. My hair's way darker. Like, it's...
Alex grew a beard to help, like, differentiate, and it didn't really help at all.
I'm still waiting for the day when someone says, like, oh, you shaved your beard? And then the funniest is, like, that card, one of his cards got left at one of the shops we go to, and someone had written on it, return to Bobby's brother, like, on the card. He sent me a picture of it. That was so funny. Like, but yeah, so, I mean, back on subject here, it's, you know, we're kind of coming to the end of this. We'll be wrapping this up in a minute, but... I can't recommend it enough. Out of everything we've done in Magic, I mean, really looking at the long-term effect, like, this podcast is an effect of this team.
Yep.
We're branching into all kinds of other things together. I mean, we're hanging out now doing non-Magic related things. Like, I mean, it's crazy to have a hobby where, like, Alex and Chris, I wouldn't know these two guys if it weren't for Magic. We really, like, that was how we met. We were strictly Magic friends, and now these are guys that I hang out with all the time on the weekends. Like, it's just so good to have that kind of bond and that ongoing thing where you can just be comfortable around people, you can have a blast, you can add that extra level of, like, it's not all about winning. At the end of the day, it is. Like, I love winning. We're all super competitive guys, but, like, Magic is a game of variance. Like, it's going to happen. Like, you're going to fumble, you're going to punt, you're going to get bad beats. And it's just nice to have that sort of support team around you for when that happens.
I honestly don't think I would be anywhere near as good if it wasn't for having Alex on the team, if it wasn't for having you, Chris. And, I mean, Bobby, you and I, I'm sure we'd be playing together, but I don't think we would be nearly as competitive as what we are now.
I can't say if I'd even be playing, to be totally honest, anymore. I mean... Maybe, probably, but who knows? Like, it's just had that level of effect on me. Like,
yeah,
it makes it easier to take time off. It gets you back into it. People can, you have people, like, outside influences, things like your spouse, girlfriend, significant others, what have you. they don't see it from a Magic perspective. So when they see you get burned out, they don't really know how to handle it. Whereas other Magic players that you're close to and been friends with for so long can see, like, all right, just take some time off, chill out. Take some time off, chill out. You'll be good in a few weeks. It's just things that, like, Magic is such a weird hobby where it's so mysterious to people that don't play, that they just don't get it. You need support within the game. You need people who understand what's going on and everything. And I mean, it helps tenfold. But any last thoughts before we get out of this?
No, it's just, I really think if you want to improve your game and definitely make it up to that next level, strongly consider having, if not a team, a solid play group that you can always go to get advice.
A consistent group. Yeah.
Yeah. I'd say definitely network. Find some guys that you guys have the same goals, whether it's to travel to PPTQs and IQs and get qualified in the opens, or, definitely network, find that group, lock them in, and just start practicing and get that camaraderie with them.
Do some non-Magic stuff.
Watch and see how doing the other stuff with these people, it may not even be Magic related, but because they'll get comfortable and they can be blunt with you on your lines of play, how much your game will improve.
Yep. So, I mean, find some Magic acquaintances, turn them into Magic friends. Turn them into regular friends. It helps tenfold. I mean, I can't recommend it enough. But all right, so that's going to wrap it up for this week. Before we get out of this, I want to mention a few things. First, please, please, please check out our website at www.thesnapcast.com. The cast is being posted in multiple places now, so not everyone listening may not be on that site already. So check that out. You can subscribe by email. We've got a feedback page on there, and we're always dying to hear feedback. Just like our Magic game, we're always trying to improve on this cast. We're still kind of finding our bearings and our voice as we go. So anything from if you just want to rant and rave about how bad a segment was to if you think an explanation of something would have helped you understand, like anything helps us tons, and we appreciate every little bit. Also beyond that, we're kind of playing with the idea of hosting articles on our website. We were thinking about writing them ourselves at first, but we thought that might pull from podcast information too much. We might have some crossbreeding there. So if you are interested at all in submitting articles, please definitely just hit us up. Let us know. Beyond that, we've set up a Facebook page now too that we're trying to get more following on. If that's your preferred method, you know, we'll be posting every time a new cast goes up. So if that's the easiest thing for you, that's at facebook.com/thesnapcastmtg. And that's going to do it for us this week. We will see you next week.